This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, and welcome to Ask an Astronomer. I'm here today with Professor Anna Scaife, who will be answering all of your astronomical questions. I say all of them, just two, but here we go. So we've had a question from Sean Mulcahy, who asks, what is the expected remaining lifespan for the Lovell telescope? I understand that the instruments can be continuously updated, but what about the superstructure? Keep up the good work. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah, this is a great question. So as Sean says, the instruments on the Lovell, the receivers that we use, are constantly being updated. The receivers are cutting edge. They're right at the forefront of astronomy science, and that's important both for us here at Jodrell Bank and for all of the other astronomers around the world who use the instrument. But the superstructure itself also gets updated. Anyone who's seen the Lovell telescope will know that it's pretty impressive. You can see it for miles. It's a big thing. It's a heavy thing. The dish on the Lovell weighs about 1,500 tons. It's huge. And the structure that supports it is correspondingly big, if you like, but also complex. And we do update it. So one of the things that gets updated most regularly, I don't know if you'd say regularly, but has been updated a couple of times, is the surface on the dish. Obviously, the dish is out there in all weathers, completely exposed, and like any other structure, bridges, buildings, it suffers from the elements. And the original surface that went up on the telescope went up in 1957, which is quite a long time ago now, 60 years ago, and it's actually been changed twice since that time. The first time it was changed was in the right at the end of the 1960s. It took until 1971 to get it changed. And the reason that it was changed was that there was actually some wear and tear on the bearings that actually move the dish around. And so it was decided that we needed to put on two big wheel girders to distribute the weight of the dish more evenly on the rest of the structure, and specifically onto the railway tracks that you might have seen if you've ever been to visit the Lovell. The Lovell rotates on railway tracks. And so two big wheel girders were put in, and in order to make that work, the dish surface actually had to be raised from where it was previously. So again, if you look at a picture of the Lovell, you'll see that there's kind of a rim, a vertical rim around the edges of the dish. And that rim raises the new 1971 surface above the old 1957 surface and makes it work with the new wheel girder, which is the big sort of semicircular thing you can see underneath the dish. So that was the first time that the surface was redone, 1971, it was finished. But again, it doesn't last forever. And so it was redone again in 2000, and it took about the same amount of time to replace it, about 2 years. So the surface that you see, or that we use now on the Lovell, is actually the third surface. And it's not only about replacing the bits that are starting to rust and get affected by the weather, but we also improve the telescope when we replace the surface. So the superstructure is actually scientifically important as well. And what we did every time we improved the surface was that we made it smoother. And a smoother surface means that you can observe at higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths. And so we improved the capabilities of the telescope. The one thing we lost by putting the big wheel girder in place was the ability to tip the telescope upside down.
I didn't realise that you used to be able to do that.
Yeah, I never saw it myself, but I've seen photographs of it. So these days, when you replace the receivers at the top of the telescope, you literally have to go up and take everything up with you, which is a huge job because it's a long way up. But originally, the whole surface used to tip upside down, so the receiver cabin was facing downwards, and you could just like stretch up and put the receivers in, which must have been amazing. I really wish that I'd been able to see it. But yeah, once the wheel girder was in place, no more of that.
Alas.
Yeah. So the answer to the question is that the telescope will keep observing for as long as it's needed for science. And since it is still the third largest fully steerable radio telescope in the world, and it's very difficult to build fully steerable radio telescopes bigger than the Lovell, it's going to be scientifically important basically for the foreseeable future, so at least the next 50 years, possibly the next 100, and we'll just keep updating the superstructure in the same way that we keep updating the receivers.
Ah, brilliant. Thank you. So our next question is from Yoda the Oak on Twitter, who says, have we worked out if a galaxy has a magnetic influence on light, or is it just down to gravity lensing?
This is a great question, and when I read it, I was like, yes. This actually relates to a lot of the science that I do, and that Emma does. So yes, the answer is yes. The magnetic fields in galaxies do have an effect on light, in the sense that light is just another frequency of electromagnetic radiation. But it's not just the magnetic fields alone. So galaxies are full of magnetic fields, we know that. They're also full of electrons. And when you put magnetic fields and electrons together, they have a profound effect on electromagnetic radiation. And it's quite different from gravitational lensing that we see due to the gravitational mass of the galaxy. The effect that the magnetic fields have on electromagnetic radiation is that they rotate its polarization, which is perhaps not the most obvious thing to a lot of people. But basically what happens is that electromagnetic radiation has a preferential direction, if you like, and that's known as its polarization. And we literally define it as an angle. So when we make an image of incident radiation on the sky, we can make an image of the angle of its polarization as well. And as that radiation passes through a galaxy, through basically a big ball of magnetic fields and electrons, the different components of the polarization travel at different speeds. And this is a consequence of an effect called the Lorentz force, which is something that you might even have seen at school, which is that electrons move in circular paths around magnetic fields. So depending on the direction of the magnetic fields in the galaxy, some of them will be moving in the same direction as the polarization of the electromagnetic radiation, and some of them will be moving in the opposite direction, so clockwise or counterclockwise. And those two components of electromagnetic radiation then travel at different speeds, because some of them are aligned with the motion of the electrons and some of them are anti-aligned with the motion of the electrons. And so when they exit the galaxy in the foreground, so on their way to us, they've actually their relationship between the two components has changed, and that rotates the overall polarization of the electromagnetic radiation. The effect is called Faraday rotation, and it's really useful because it allows us to look at the degree of rotation that we see from the galaxy and then infer the strength of the magnetic fields that must have been there in order to cause it. And it's one of the primary ways that we're able to measure magnetic fields in the universe, because magnetic fields on their own are, well, they're very quiet. They don't produce anything that we can visibly see. So we have to look at the effects that they have on other things. But of course, they're incredibly important. They're completely ubiquitous across all of the structure that we see in the universe, from the very largest scales of, you know, cosmic structure formation down to the formation of protostars within our own galaxy. So measuring how strong they are is really important. And Faraday rotation is absolutely key to doing that.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Anna.
Cheers, Emma.